Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Chick Dumbach. Chick has written this book, Exhaust the Limits, The Life and Times of a Global Peacebuilder. His sojourn has been fascinating. He's now president and CEO of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. He's been president of the National Peace Corps Association, Operation Respect, lots of things that touch on life here in Baltimore, around Maryland as well, and the nation. He's done many, many things, which we'll explore in the course of our conversation. And, Chick, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
It's great to see, great to meet you. And we were talking earlier that this book is published by Apprentice House here at Loyola University.
That's right. By great folks.
Dear friend Greg Wilhelm.
Certainly.
Who's built a publishing house. I'm just amazed. And this is the kind of book he's publishing now, which is really good.
I appreciate it. It's good to be a part of it.
So this life you've led, I mean, you'll hear us, folks, as we go through this conversation, it takes us through Colombia and Rwanda and peacekeeping in Rwanda and conversations of peace in the Congo and on the Eritrean-Ethiopian border and within those nations and more. This whole idea is a really idea of peace. Even the emails I see you've sent over the last few days about the U.S. Institute for Peace,
yes,
and the struggle, which you can explain to our listeners here in a moment, that the whole idea of peace and peace building is like secondary. It's made to feel and appear as if it is something attached to war, as opposed to having an essence of its own that can speak to humanity.
Well, what we would like to see is it become what you're describing, an essence of its own, that where it is not necessarily attached to war. And I think when we talk about peace building, when we intentionally attach that word building to it when we talk about it. Unfortunately, the word peace has taken on various connotations in various circles, and astonishing to me, some people even have a negative connotation of the word peace. How can that be?
Because it's impossible. It can't be, and it's just something that is against human nature for some reason.
That's what they say.
Right?
That's what they say, and it's utter nonsense. Peace is essential to human nature. Every now and then we stray into violence, but the norm is to live at peace. But the reason we use the term peace building is to say we've got to build it. It doesn't just happen because we pray about it or march in the streets about it or those things. All those things are fine. I've done it all. But what we're learning, and this is the wonderful thing that's going on right now, and this is brand new in all of human history, is studying peace as a whole new way to structure society, to build it around the concept of peace and putting in place systems and mechanisms to resolve conflicts without resorting to the use of violent force. And that's what we're doing, and it's remarkably effective. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. And it's very exciting to be a part of it.
So why is it you think that, before I come back to the U.S. Institute for Peace, I want to do that for you.
Sure.
Jump into the heart of the book. Why is it you think that if we as human beings live our life in relative peace most every day, we have our conflicts and our issues, but you can live next door to or with somebody who you may disagree with vehemently on every issue that we care about under the sun, but you live your lives together. You may even help build a piece of his house, or loan him your tools, or take care of his dog or children, or whatever it is, despite all those differences, yet it's given such a minimal, it's seen as so minimally important that is the aberration. And what's really common is our conflict, our war. I mean, there's really that humankind can't live without war. Why do you think this imbalance exists?
Well, I think it's because we have not yet put in place the systems and the mechanisms and developed the attitudes at the macro level. At the micro level, we do live at peace. I mean, every now and then, there's criminal behavior and
right.
so on. I mean, that happens. But we certainly don't let our children, when our kids get mad at each other, we don't supply them with hand grenades and knives and pistols. Do we?
Let's hope not.
No, we don't. I've raised three boys, and they fight and so on, but we don't arm them.
Right.
and at the community level, if you get mad at your neighbor, you don't put landmines along the border to keep them off your property. Some of my best friends have just totally opposite political points of view, and I'll tell you what we do: we'll get on the phone and we'll yell at each other, literally yell at each other, and then just break up laughing. Saying, you've got your point of view, I've got mine, and we'll fight it out verbally
right
till the day we die, but we love each other, and we're going to, and we find ways to work these things out so that we can coexist. And that happens at virtually every level except the macro level, at the state level and the international level. And for some reason, we seem to think it's a good thing at that level, particularly at the international level, to be militarily dominant and to beat up on people that you don't like. It just makes no sense at all. The good news is that there's a growing awareness that is, in fact, that it makes no sense to do that. The Europeans went through centuries of just brutal beating up each other, killing each other, torturing each other, and it took two world wars for them to finally say, wait a second, this is really stupid. This is stupid.
Yeah.
Let's find another way. And much of the rest of the world is recognizing that as well and coming out of it and saying, wait a second, let's find a different way. Let's find a better way. And it's even though there's still a lot of violent conflict in Africa and in some parts of Asia, they're getting better. They are coming to this realization. The African Union is working on ways to work these things out. They've got a long ways to go, but they're making real progress.
Do you find that when you have worked – say, in the Congo, around Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
or whether it was in Eritrea, Ethiopia, or wherever that may be you happen to be, that you begin to find, even in what you might find is the, at the core of somebody you really disagree with, you dislike what they've done, that you learn from them, that there's something else inside of them besides the distaste you might think you have for them.
Absolutely. I'll tell you the thing that I've found. I'm on a first name basis. One of those, some of the people you read about in the newspapers and see pictures in the magazines as being, you know, what are perceived as some of the most odious people on the planet. But I get to know them, literally become friends with them, because I'm willing to listen to them and understand they have a point of view as well. They have a reason for doing what they're doing. Now, in some cases, there are some megalomaniacs who you can't carry on that kind of a conversation with. That's a tiny, tiny portion of the population. But these people have a reason for doing what they're doing, and if you'll show some respect and listen and understand, then they respect you in return, and then together you can find a way out of the use of violent force to bring about a peaceful resolution to the conflict that they're involved with. If I may, just very quickly, with regard to the Congo, we got to know the leaders of the major rebel groups, as well as didn't get to know President Kabila well, got to know him a little bit, but his top advisors. And we'd ask each of them, you know, what's going on here? Why this incredibly brutal civil war? Well, each of them would say essentially the same thing, you know, that the government is incompetent and corrupt, and if we take over, we'll build roads and schools, build democratic institutions, end the corruption, everything will be wonderful. Well, all of them wanted to achieve the same thing. And so we then would bring them together and say, you know, we're pretty impressed with what all of you want, but you know that using violence is not going to get you there. It's going to destroy everything that you say you want to see happen in the country. There's only one way to get there, and that is you don't have to like each other, but you got to work together for the good of the country. They literally went for a walk in the woods, came out of the woods and said, let's give it a try. That, and these are people, again, that you've read about in the newspapers as being these horrible, horrible people. Well, they're not horrible, horrible people. They're people who care passionately about their cause and just hadn't really thought through a different way of going about it.
And you said something a bit ago when you talked about the history of Europe.
Yeah.
And I think that especially among Americans, and I would say generally speaking among white people in the world, that they look at what's going on in Africa and nations in the continent of Africa, and there's this attitude of savages, attitude of they don't know how to run a country. They don't know what they're doing. Forgetting human history. Forgetting where people are, forgetting colonialism, forgetting human history, forgetting the struggles those places go through. I mean, we really do that a lot.
And forgetting what we went through.
What we went through.
Our own civil war, dare say.
Right.
About as brutal as any violent conflict in the history of the planet.
Lynching in the South, keeping...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. This white arrogance is utter nonsense. We have no moral standing whatsoever. We simply happen to have, the Europeans have happened to have figured something out. and much of the rest of the world has as well, but there are places that are still working their way through this. But again, the good news is that increasingly around the world there is a growing understanding that the use of violent force just doesn't get you where you want to be, that there are better ways to get there.
Talk a minute. Let's go back to where the first thing I was trying to raise with you was your emails about the U.S. Institute for Peace.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about that.
Well, for one thing, again, this whole concept of intentionally thinking through how to build a more peaceful world is a very recent phenomenon. And one illustration of that is the U.S. Institute of Peace. It was created in 1984, very recent. We've had military academies for a long, long time. We finally got around to putting in place essentially an academy to study and analyze how to build a more peaceful world and the role that the United States can play in helping to make that happen. It's called the U.S. Institute of Peace. It is tiny. It has a budget of about $40 million, which is a round-off figure, of course, in regard to anything else in the federal budget. But it does extraordinary work. The research that they do, the training that they provide, and on-the-ground work, including being directly involved with the surge in Iraq. General Petraeus gives U.S. Institute of Peace primary credit for turning the corner on the surge. The surge wasn't sending more troops over to shoot more people. Mm-hmm. It was a completely different attitude, which was to work with the people instead of shooting the people. That's what made the surge work. You know where the thinking for that came from? Came from the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's where it came from. So if you work with people, maybe you won't have to shoot them. Maybe they won't shoot you.
So what is the U.S. Institute of Peace? What does it do?
Well, it's set up as an independent institution, but created by the Congress and funded by the Congress for the purpose of studying and analyzing what it would take to build a more peaceful world and what role the United States can play in that. They also provide training for people within the government, State Department officials, military officials, others, USAID, and for people in civil society, in the non-governmental sector. And they also have their experts who are deployed to various trouble spots around the world to get directly involved in conflict resolution. And they do a remarkable job of it. Unfortunately, this Congress, in its determination to cut everything in sight, and particularly if they don't know anything about or understand what something is doing, then they say, well, then we can just cut that out. You know, the statement was made, well, they're doing the same thing the State Department does, so we'll just eliminate it.
Right.
My response to that is, well, then I'm willing to go along with that on one condition, that we also zero fund the Marines because they are similar to the Navy.
Right.
If you're willing to do that, I'm willing to agree. If you're not willing to do that, I will not agree. I'm sorry. There is a difference between the Navy and the Marines, and there is a difference between the State Department and the Institute of Peace.
So how's it fared?
Well,
how is it faring, I should say?
Well, we're in the middle of the struggle.
Right.
In the middle of the struggle. The House voted to zero fund the U.S. Institute of Peace,
right,
to eliminate it completely. The Senate is... has in its budget a $39.5 million figure, a modest cut from where it should be. But, you know, in this climate, you've got to be willing to live with some things like that. The White House has assured us that it will stand firm on funding for the Institute of Peace. But you never know in this climate.
No,
when they get
know.
Behind the closed doors, when the House and the Senate go out and just start hammering out what they are and aren't going to cut, you just don't know what's going to happen. So we're mobilizing as much support as we can. This is an institution that nobody's ever heard of.
Right. Oh, no, I know. It's unknown.
People like you, you know, a lifelong devotee of building a more peaceful world. You've never heard of the U.S. Institute of Peace.
I've heard of it, but I never really – I've heard of it, but having read your emails come through the last few days before this interview, I started thinking about, well, you know, I've heard of this U.S. Institute for Peace, but – what does it do? It seems like it's – is it one of these things, amorphous,
mm-hmm,
you know, we feel good, let's go out and promote American policy in the world, but do it peacefully? I mean, and until I started looking at it and preparing for you to come in the studios, I had no idea
right.
what it did. None.
And virtually no one in Congress knows anything about it. They have not had a hearing. It was created 26 years ago, 27 years ago.
Under Reagan.
Under Reagan, absolutely,
right.
Absolutely. And George Shultz is one of the greatest advocates for the U.S. Institute of Peace. So the military just thinks it's great. They love it. But and by the way, the strongest supporters for the work we do in the peacebuilding world are the people in uniform. Every time I meet with them, which is regularly, they look at me and say, we want you to succeed. We want you peacebuilders to succeed. We don't want to shoot at people, and we certainly don't want people shooting at us. We're with you. We want you guys to grow and be more and more effective. I didn't expect that when I first started meeting with military people.
More about the horror of war than the men who fight.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they tell me. They say, we are the strongest supporters you have out there. But at any rate, for the Institute of Peace, the budget is so small that nobody ever paid any attention to it. No hearings in Congress since it was created, because nobody paid any attention to it. Now all at once they say, well, gee, we haven't been paying attention. We don't even know what you do, so we'll just eliminate you. Without one hearing, without one bit of research, without one bit of analysis as to whether or not it is cost beneficial. If they did even the slightest analysis, they would find out that for that pittance of an expense, it literally saves billions of dollars every year in what would otherwise take to carry out military operations that they help avoid the necessity for.
Now, let's take a step back, Chris. We're talking with Chick Dumbuck. His book is Exhaust the Limits, and it's a memoir of his life and the work that he's done to building peace in this world since he was a very young man. So one of the things that's interesting to me, in the beginning of this book, you talk about – trying to find a place for all these things here. Put this here for a moment. You talk about your sojourn in college as a football player.
Yeah.
You were an athlete.
I was. That was pretty good.
I'm sure you were. Canoeing, kayaking, playing football.
Yeah, it's fun.
You know? But you had an experience in college that kind of blew your mind, that involved a man named Earl Bud Jones.
That's
and
right.
A coach. Tell that story.
I'll try to do it without getting too emotional, because this was 45 years ago, and it still makes me cry.
When I read it, I was going, same thing happened to me. I can imagine how, if you were in it, what it did to you.
And by the way, I had a long talk with Earl again yesterday.
We're
having so much fun reconnecting. But the basic story is I went to Oklahoma State University. The team had just been integrated a couple of years before. But they brought in a coaching staff that, frankly, was about as racist as you could imagine.
We're talking about what year are we talking about?
This is the mid-60s.
Right.
So the rule then, it's probably the same thing now, was if you're on a scholarship and you get hurt, the school has to keep you on scholarship until your graduation date, you know, because that's just part of the contract. But if you quit, then you lose your scholarship. Earl and I got hurt just about the same time, to where we wouldn't be able to play anymore.
You ripped your shoulder.
Shoulder separation, so I couldn't play anymore. Earl hurt his knee, knew he wouldn't be able to play anymore. For me, that was fine. I was a white guy. Earl was a black guy, and they wanted to make him quit. And they basically, we were getting ready to play a team that had a great quarterback. So in a practice, they had him stand where the quarterback would stand and had the defensive line attack him. But they didn't attack him the way you normally would, with your hands high to block the pass. No, the instructions were to hit him as hard as possible on his bad knee, and they wouldn't stop play until everyone on the defensive line had hit him and hit him hard on his bad knee. Of course, the first couple of times they wouldn't do it, and the coach came up and literally ripped the helmets off the defensive lines and hit them in the face and said, I said hit him in the knee! Hit him in the knee! And after a while, they finally had to. This went on and on and on. Earl was and they would say, when are you going to quit, nigger? When are you going to quit? And he wouldn't quit. And I was so impressed with Earl. And he was my friend. He was down on his knees, couldn't even stand anymore. When are you going to quit? When are you going to quit? Well, he wouldn't quit. He's laying on the ground, couldn't even get up on his knees. Finally, the head coach came down and just said, get out of here, nigger. And Earl crawled off the field. I had not, and the thing that bothered me after this had happened, I thought, I did nothing. How could I have done that to my friend? I did nothing to help him. He crawled off the field, and I lost contact with my friend Earl Jones. The amazing thing is that I wrote this about 2 years ago. about 2 weeks after I had written this. And by the way, I talked to other players on the team to make sure I got it right because I didn't want to misrepresent what had happened. They said, Chick, you got the story just right. About 2 weeks after I had written it up, I got an email from Earl Jones. And I just broke down in tears. Thought, wow, unbelievable. And I called him up and I told him what I had done, that I had just written his story. And I said, I'm not sure I want to send it to you because I'm not sure you want to bring up these bad memories. He said, please send it to me. I sent it to him. But I said, I hope this doesn't cause problems. He says, no, Chick. He says, I'm sleeping now for the first time in 40 years.
Wow.
Because you validated what happened to me. He had been through psychologists, every kind of treatment imaginable, and he still had post-traumatic stress syndrome for all those 45 years. And because of this validation, he is now, as he said himself, he has come out of the dark side and is happy. Yes. And I just like, whoa!
But it started your sojourn.
Oh, yes. What happened to him started me. It just changed me because I felt so guilty about not having done anything for Earl. I thought, never again can I let something like that happen. I've got to become a part of the effort to make this a better world.
So you at that point in your life were how old was this? You were 18, 19?
Well, I was about my junior year, so I was in my early 20s.
Okay, early 20s.
Yeah.
You were battling whether or not to become this Olympic athlete. You wanted to be an Olympic athlete really badly.
Yep.
And this other thing was in your head.
Yep.
This idea that you could lead a different mm-hmm. kind of life, mm-hmm. make a difference in a different way.
Yes. And I did try to make the Olympic team, but came close, didn't make it. And by the way, part of the appeal, I had already, when I was doing that, because that was after playing football, I became a kayak racer and did quite well. But part of my motivation of being involved in international athletics was that I saw things like the Olympics as being a way of bringing different people and different cultures together. And so in my involvement with the sport, when we would travel around the world to different competitions, I'd make sure that the athletes that I was with said, don't just hang out at the competition venue. Go into town. Meet people. Get to know people from other parts of the world. You have an extraordinary opportunity.
How many Olympics did you end up working in?
I worked in three.
In three.
Seoul, Barcelona, and Atlanta.
And that was – and that, so you lived your passion that way?
Yes.
As well?
Yeah, sure did.
Didn't let it go.
What a lucky guy.
Yeah.
What a lucky guy.
You've done okay.
Yeah.
And you went – so talk about you going to the March on Washington in 1963.
Well, no, I didn't go to the March on Washington.
Oh, I thought about you did
you, go. You went. I didn't. I was practicing at Oklahoma State at the time, I saw it on television.
All right. You saw it on television. Right,
between
right,
the right. morning – this was during two-day workouts, which are just brutal, just incredibly brutal workouts. And so you're just totally exhausted. And the team gathered in the basement of the dorm. This is back again in 1963. Small black and white television. And I'm watching something unfold that I didn't fully understand but was really, really powerful. And that along with what happened to Earl Jones was among those things that just got my thinking. There's something going on in this world that is changing the world, and I need to be a part of it.
This is what it made me think of, and I'm sorry. Sometimes I read stuff, things get jumbled in my head, so I apologize.
That's all right.
But one of the things that hit me was you're looking at this TV set with Martin Luther King delivering his speech.
Yes.
The stuff is whirling around you around race in Oklahoma.
Yep. Yep.
Where you were a student. The very end of your book, and I'm trying to find if I can find the part. The very end of your book, you said, when you were at the inauguration of President Barack Obama,
yes.
that how intoxicating that moment was.
Yes.
Being in, watching this thing and watching it unfold on television.
Yes.
At the inauguration. So it was these two TV experiences, but you had a life experience around both of them.
In some ways, bookends.
Bookends.
Hopefully it's not the end.
No, not the end.
But in a way, metaphorically, a bookend.
Metaphorically, yes.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
So I was really struck by that.
Yeah. I'm glad you picked up on that. I did that intentionally.
Okay. Because there's something about that.
Yes.
And I'd like you to describe your experience and all that and what that has meant to you. I mean, it made me think of being a young civil rights worker. Standing with Fannie Lou Hamer in 1964 in Atlantic City when I was 18 years old, and then watching Barack Obama give his speech at the Democratic Convention when I was covering it.
Like,
It was overwhelming.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we started doing these things, it was the impossible dream. We were foolish and naive for taking it on and believing that something like this could actually happen. But and when I say we, I'm talking about you and all of the people
tens
that were part
of
this.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And my good friends, Peter Yarrow and Noel Paul Stuckey, who I've gotten to know. And, of course, their music has been so much a part of this. And then the other troubadours of these movements. All of us, just kind of dismissed as naive idealists who, this will never happen.
Right.
Well, it did happen.
Yes, it did, didn't it?
It happened. It's possible to make this world better. It's possible to change human behavior. It's possible to change attitudes. And we did it. We did it. Now, there's still a long ways to go, but the progress is astonishing. And so, when people around me say, well, how do you stay so optimistic and enthusiastic about this stuff? See, look at the progress we've made. And when I think back to what the world was like, the world that I was born into and raised in, compared with where we are now, it's astonishing the progress that we've made just in one generation.
It's amazing.
Look what we've done. And then before we started this program, we're talking about the young people, people in their 20s and 30s. Wow, what a generation. I love them. I love them. They are so good.
They are.
They are going to pick up where we leave off and continue to make this a much, much, much better world.
Nothing better than to talk to a group of people in their 20s.
They're so good.
Young people from the Institute for Policy Studies are just doing this incredible work. Young women who are out there fighting to end the slave trade of women and just putting the heart – it's just – they're there.
Yeah, yeah.
So you went from college to Columbia.
I did. Peace Corps.
Peace Corps. And that's a sojourn that changed your life as well.
Well, it just continued the change, but each step makes it even more so. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, no question.
But what I meant that changed your life is that this – when you went to the Peace Corps and talked a bit about that experience, I mean this really – what really began – the roots of your commitment to voting yourself to peace.
Yes.
In this world of building peace.
That's right. I kind of went from the civil rights movement to expanding that concept to the entire world and recognizing. And I think the main thing that happened there is you find yourself in a completely different culture and yet finding, gee, these are human beings as well. I was living with people who made $100 a year. $100 a year. If a family in the village had a change of clothing instead of just one set of clothing, they were the rich people. And no electricity, no running water, a bowl or two of rice a day, and maybe if they caught enough fish, a little bit of fish on it and some fruit trees in the area. But that was it. And with a smile on their face. Oh, wait a second.
Right.
How can they have a smile on their face? And as long as they had enough food, which they didn't always have. When they didn't have enough food, they weren't smiling. But as long as they had enough food, protection from the elements, they knew how to enjoy their own lives and they knew how to enjoy one another. Wow, what a lesson that is.
Yep.
But also recognizing during that time the Vietnam War is going on, thinking, wait a second, the people in Vietnam are just like these people that I'm learning to know and love as real human beings. How can we be doing that? How can we be dropping napalm on these people and treating them as though they're subhuman? They're not subhuman. They're every bit as human as anybody else. And so that really intensified this sense of the wrong of the use of violent force. And so that it just kind of broadened my horizons to essentially become a global citizen and care as much about the people in other parts of the world as I do the people at home. I care about people at home, but I say this is a whole world community.
And you, when you came back and started becoming involved in the Association of Peace Corps Veterans, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
And I was really found interesting the divide that took place in that group. At that moment,
it was very interesting. Of course, this was the late 60s, early 70s, when Vietnam was the decisive factor in so many things. And and there were people who were radicalized by it. I wasn't radicalized by it. I've never been a radical. I was never a hippie. I never grew my hair long. And I never became an opponent of the U.S. government. I was critical of the U.S. government, but not an opponent. But some of the people who came out of the Peace Corps experience were radicalized by it and felt that the entire U.S. government was the enemy. And the Peace Corps is a part of the government, and so they thought the Peace Corps was also a part of the enemy. And they literally took over the Peace Corps building
and
closed it down.
Right.
And
right.
I wanted to be a part of the anti-war movement, but I felt they were going too far. That this was a misunderstanding of certainly of the Peace Corps and of how things can be made better. So I never became a part of that organization, But I'd always felt there should be a strong organization of former Peace Corps volunteers. These are extraordinary people with amazing experiences. So when the war ended, the reason for that organization to be ended, and so it kind of faded away. So a couple of decades later, we were able to put together a network of former Peace Corps volunteers called the National Peace Corps Association, and I was selected of all people to be the president of that organization and to run it. And I'll have to say that indeed is the privilege of a lifetime, to be the person who gets to speak on behalf of the people who served in the Peace Corps. I aspired to make the Olympic team, even hoped one day I'd win an Olympic gold medal. One of my best friends has two Olympic gold medals. But give me a choice between being the spokesperson for the people who served in the Peace Corps and 10 Olympic gold medals.
Right.
I'll take the Peace Corps any day. What an honor. What a privilege to be the president of the National Peace Corps Association, to testify before congressional committees and to speak on college campuses and so on behalf of the Peace Corps community. Wow. What an honor.
We're here with Chick Dumbuck. His book is Exhaust the Limits, The Life and Times of a Global Peace Builder. Chick is here in our studios in Baltimore this morning, and he's president and CEO now of the Alliance for Peace Building. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to examine just what his work is about today, what he's done in Rwanda and in the Congo, what he's did in the Ethiopia, Eritrean area, what he's been doing for world peace. We'll come back with all that and more. So stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New Easy. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We have a Charles Dumbuck in our studio. Chick has written this book, Exhaust the Limits, The Life and Times of a Global Peace Builder. And he is now the president and CEO of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. We'll talk about that and much more during the course of the rest of our conversation with him. And this book is published by our own Apprentice House here in Baltimore. what you were able to leap into in all this really kind of blew my mind. I always kind of am in awe of seeing how things transpire for different human beings. Here you are, you're head of this group, the Peace Corps group of the veterans coming back. You've done remarkable work in that and pushing this whole idea of peace. But a couple of things happened. One is you say more than once in this book that you wanted the Peace Corps to be about rebuilding peace. That was the name of the book itself, the name of the Corps itself, that was the missing element, not knowing how to create peace among warring groups in conflict. And that was the one thing you wanted to see the Peace Corps become.
Well, and it bothered me when I was a Peace Corps volunteer that when a fight broke out in the village, I didn't know a thing about what to do about it. I thought, I'm cuerpo de paz. I'm here as a Peace Corps volunteer, and there's a fight, and I don't know how to bring peace to these people who are fighting with each other. It really bothered me. But there is a reason the Peace Corps itself and the volunteers themselves don't get involved in that kind of thing. For one thing, we serve in countries at the invitation of the host government. Well, if the Peace Corps volunteers start getting involved in that, the welcome mat could be pulled out very, very quickly.
Right.
Furthermore, pretty darn vulnerable. We're out living alone in these remote villages. Well, if we become perceived as being part of the political process or part of the conflict process, you get kidnapped and hurt in a heartbeat. And so those are the reasons the Peace Corps itself does not get involved in these things. It is a part of the peace process in that it builds positive relations among people and helps with development, and that's part of it. But the Peace Corps is not involved in conflict resolution. And I felt that at least people who served in the Peace Corps later in our lives, when we're no longer serving as volunteers, maybe we could get involved in that. And through the National Peace Corps Association, I had a platform from which we could start to make that happen. So and several of the former volunteers were doing it. The Friends of Liberia group has done extraordinary work. Apart from anything I did, they just took it on themselves.
They had these,
and
all these friends groups that began. These were the people
that's
who served
right.
a given country created
that's right.
Friends of
that's
that given
right.
country.
So there's I'm part of Friends of Colombia. There's Friends of Kenya, Friends of Liberia. You name it, Friends of Thailand. You know, so these are people who serve in those countries who continue to maintain their identity with and involvement with the countries. But in 1994, of course, the genocide broke out in Rwanda, and this country did nothing about it. In fact, President Clinton and Madeleine Albright both say it was the biggest mistake of the Clinton presidency was to do nothing about Rwanda. But a friend of mine named Steve Smith out in California called and said, we've got to do something about it. If the government's not going to do anything else, we Peace Corps people have got to. And we did. And there was one government program called the Office of Transition Initiatives, brand new program in the USAID, and a guy named Rick Barton, who's now our number two person at the United Nations, and Rick's just a spectacular human being. Rick recognized that the people who could do the most good were people who served there in the Peace Corps, knew the language, knew the culture. They could get off the plane, go right to work, and figure out what needed to be done. There was no plan. Nobody knew what needed to be done. We needed people on the ground who could talk to people, listen and understand what needed to be done, and just plain do it.
As you said in the book, I think, you work in a land in Rwanda and take machetes out of the hands of people doing the killing.
Yeah. So we our people, as the violence was subsiding, we were able to dispatch about 25 to 30 people. These people quit their jobs to go back to Rwanda to do what they could do. And we ended up providing the training for the human rights monitors, ended up working with people in the villages throughout the country to help build stability and a sense of security so that the country could come back together and move on. And it was an extraordinary experience. We barely slept for several months, but it was an absolutely phenomenal experience. And it was successful.
What do you mean when you say it was successful? Talk a bit about what that means.
Well, what I mean by that is that in the villages where the former Peace Corps volunteers, where they went back and were able to work with people, there was – and we weren't the only ones. There were others involved with this as well. But we were able to create a sense that the violence was over and that it would be possible to regroup and to move on. That was really one of the fundamental things that the former Peace Corps volunteers were able to do, was build a sense of stability and security and hope that the country could come back together and move on. And it has. I mean, you know, some people complain about Paul Kagame and some of his policies and ways of operating, but you talk about a phenomenal success story. Rwanda is an amazing story. And the credit goes to Kagame and to the Rwandan people themselves. But we did have the opportunity to be a part of it, and I'm awfully proud of the role that we and the Peace Corps community was able to play in that.
So, I mean, but this kind of work, this conflict resolution, has taken you to a number of places.
Sure has. Fascinating.
Congo. Eritrea, Ethiopia.
Yep. Let me start with Ethiopia and Eritrea, because that was because sequentially.
It's because one of your folks from that pops back up into your life in another country.
Indeed.
So,
Ethiopia and Eritrea, 1998, border war broke out. Eritrea gained independence from Ethiopia in about 1993. Things looked like they were going well for both countries, but they never marked the border, and tensions started to build between the leaders of the two countries. And a skirmish broke out in this little tiny town called Badame on the border. Ethiopia was administering Badame. Eritrea thought that it should be part of Eritrea. And a skirmish broke out there, and it just exploded into a large-scale war. John Garamendi, John had been a Peace Corps volunteer in Ethiopia, was Deputy Secretary of Interior in the Clinton administration. He called me one day and said, Chick, my friends are killing each other, and we've got to do something about it. I said, John, I don't know what we're going to do, but let's talk. We got together, and we talked about it, and we called the two embassies and said, you know, we don't know if we could be helpful or not. We don't know if you want us to be involved, but if you do, we're ready to do whatever we can. And they said, please come help. We've gotten ourselves into a terrible situation, and we trust you because you're Peace Corps. And so we built a trust relationship with the ambassadors, with the foreign ministers, and it ended up with the heads of state. And you say, how did that happen? I mean, people hear this story and say, no, Chick, that could not have happened. That's impossible. Because, you know, we had no standing. John had already left the Department of Interior. He was a private citizen. I was a private citizen. No standing whatsoever. And yet the heads of state of these two countries wanted to meet with us, ended up spending hours and hours with us in regular communication with them because they trusted us. And I'll tell you why they trusted us. Part of it was the Peace Corps. They've been taught by Peace Corps volunteers. But the other is because we listened to them. Everybody else gets involved and says, here's what you need to do to solve your problem. And they resent it. And I don't blame them for resenting it. We didn't say we have the solution to your problem. We said, we want to understand what's going on here. We want to try to help you find a way out of this because they wanted to find a way out of it. And so we'll try to help you. We have to understand your point of view of what's going on first. And time after time, we'd meet with them on both sides and listen to 20 or 30 minutes of ranting as to why they were right and the other side was wrong. Every time, even though we'd heard it over and over again, we'd patiently and respectfully listen to the whole thing and say, I understand. And you've got reason to view the world the way you do. But you also understand that the other side also has its point of view and that killing each other is no way to resolve this dispute. The determination of whether Badmei belongs in Ethiopia or Eritrea should not be based on who can kill more of the other side's people. Have you ever thought about that? Well, gee, hadn't really thought about that. Well, think about it. Should the determination of where Badmei belongs be based on who can kill more of the other side's people? And that very simple message was what got them rethinking what they were doing and how they were doing it. And at the end, when the war was finally over, it was in a conversation we were having with the president of Eritrea that he agreed to make the final concession. The prime minister of Ethiopia was willing to accept that. Came to the United States. He was on his way to the State Department to meet with Madeleine Albright, but he met with us first, invited us to have breakfast with him. And he said, I want you to know the war is over, and I want to thank you for making it happen.
You played a critical role in that.
Played a critical role, indeed. And it was, again, it was because of being able to build a trust and mutually respectful relationship, and because we were willing to listen to them. It was their war. It was their problem. They needed to find a solution to it. They just needed somebody from the outside to help guide them through that process. That's what we did.
And there's this great scene, and I'm trying to find it in history. I remember the name of the man. I love this one scene where you were in the Congo about
Haile Menkerios.
Yes, exactly right.
Ah,
yes.
What a magnificent human being.
His back is turned to you. He looks familiar.
Ah, yes. Haile Menkerios, by the way, if you've been following what's been happening in southern Sudan, it's one of the most amazing positive developments in recent times. Southern Sudan breaking away from Sudan with
right,
an election.
Right.
The guy who's responsible for overseeing all of that
is
Haile Menkerios.
He sounds like just an amazing being.
They just don't come any better than Haile Menkerios.
Take a little digression here before, as we go to the Congo. Tell us about this human being.
Well, Haile Menkerios was Eritrea's ambassador to the United Nations during the time of the Ethiopia-Eritrea border war. And we got to know him during that period of time. And he was the one person involved with governments on either side who we knew was just absolutely determined to do whatever he possibly could to bring about an end to the fighting. He got it more than anybody else that the use of violence is no way to settle this thing. And so he was our strongest ally. Everybody agreed that that's what we should do, but Heidi was just passionate about it. And, of course, he had a very strong position at the UN. So we developed this wonderful relationship with him. And when the war was over, we got together and you know, just kind of celebrated the end of
right.
the war and you know, a strong embrace and saying, you know, this is good. But shortly after the war was over, Isaias Afwerki, the president of Eritrea, was supposed to institute democratic reforms and so on, and he didn't. And he ended up becoming pretty darn authoritarian.
Yes, he did.
and Haile and 14 of his colleagues, 15 people in all, who were in high-level positions in the government, wrote a declaration that basically said, this is not the direction the country's going isn't what we fought for independence for. This isn't what we're supposed to become. They were charged with treason for doing that. In fact, 13 of the 15 are still in prison. They've been in prison for over a decade now.
That's amazing.
Haile would be in prison if he had been in Asmara, but he was in New York representing him at the UN. Of course, he lost his job at the UN as soon as that happened. But I lost touch with him, and I was terribly worried that he may have been taken back, that he might be in prison. Who knows? So fast forward about 2 years, and I was in Sun City, South Africa for the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, which was dealing with the Congo Civil War, because we got involved in that one. And so while there, we went to a place to get some coffee. Our little team of former Peace Corps volunteers played a pretty significant role in the Inter-Congolese Dialogue. But while there, I saw the profile of a man who had his back to us, and I said to our groups, that looks like Haile Menkerios. And I just told them the story about Haile and all the great work he had done and what had happened to him. You know, he'd been charged with treason. And just as I was saying that, this man turned around and he saw me. He said, Chick, what are you doing here? Haile, what are you doing here? And it was Haile. And he had been picked up by the United Nations. Kofi Annan said, you know, you're not going home and going to jail. You're working for me. And so he became Assistant Secretary, Secretary General of the United Nations. And because he is so good, the Secretary General would send him to the toughest spots in the world. You take the toughest problem anywhere in the world, the guy to send there to work on it was Haile Menkerios.
So two quick final things. One is, do you – there are a lot of people I've been reading lately who would say, who have said or positing, that the work of a lot of NGOs, the work of groups like yours, this is actually similar to what you faced during the Vietnam War with returning Peace Corps vets who were saying, we're going to take over the Peace Corps building. Okay, but it's like an updated version of that to me. And a lot of articles I've been reading, young volunteers from South America and Africa saying that what you all are doing is nothing more than pushing American policy with a dove on its face as opposed to a gun on its face.
And I can understand people feeling that way. I'll go back to the point about listening. The way we approached what we did in the Congo and in Ethiopia and Eritrea. Our first message was, we're here to help if you want us to help. We're not going to impose ourselves at all. And as long as we go in with that attitude, and we meant it. I mean, if those ambassadors from Ethiopia and Eritrea had said to John and me, butt out.
Right.
That would have been the last time we would have called on them. Now, but if on the other hand we were to say, no, you've got to change your behavior and do the things that we're telling you to do, that's imperialism. That's forcing it on them. But the people I'm satisfied that the overwhelming majority of the people in every part of the world want peace. And to the extent that the international community can come together and help build peace, that is something that is welcomed, I'll say everywhere. I'm not going to say virtually everywhere. I'm going to say that's welcomed everywhere. Furthermore, what we're doing, we are part of a phenomenal growing network that is organized through something called GPAC, the Global Partnership for the Prevention of Armed Conflict. This did not begin in the United States. It is not forced on anybody anywhere. This grew up everywhere in the world. There are about 1,000 organizations in small villages in Kenya and in Nepal and other parts and in El Salvador. Local organizations, civil society, rising up and saying to the leaders of their country, enough. Enough to violence. We won't tolerate violence anymore. And we have this global community that is all working together to build a more peaceful world. So we don't come in just as ourselves as these wonderful North Americans who are here to save you. Not at all. It's local. It's their desire to see this happen. And to the extent that we can be helpful, we want to be helpful. If they don't want us, say, we're out of here.
So where, and finally, in the final analysis, where do you see, when you look at where we began this conversation with the battle over the budget, the minuscule budget for the U.S. Institute mm-hmm. for Peace, which is pretty minuscule given the budget for everything else in America for war and whatever else we do. And we have this idea in America, as you write about, that we have – that we spend 15 to 25% of our national budget on foreign aid and taking care of the world, which we don't. Less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
And it's less than any other Western or developed
That's
nation
right.
does anywhere
we,
on the planet.
We're the cheapest when we're it comes cheapest. To foreign aid. We think we're the most generous. We are not. Audience, please, we are not. We have the sweet, put the smallest portion of our GNP into foreign aid of any developed country in the world.
Which is important for us to remember in this. So where does it go? Where do you think... You're so enamored, as I am, of this 20-somethings coming up and the work they're doing. So where does it go now, given that reality and the battle to kind of – battle is my wrong word to use – the struggle over how we – what America does, what our values are, and what puts in place. Where do we go? Do you see?
I think that we're reaching that proverbial fork in the road where we can go either of two ways. We can view the world as being a threat, which a lot of people do, and fortify ourselves and saying we're ready to take them on with guns and conquer the rest of the world and certainly kill anybody who we feel is a threat to us. Or we can say that it is a global community, that our economies are intertwined, our cultures are intertwined, distinct but intertwined. We are mutually dependent. We are either going to solve these huge problems – of environmental problems and the other and economic issues and so on. We're either going to solve these things together or we're going to duke it out and everybody loses if we choose to fight it out. If we choose to do it together, then everybody comes out ahead. I see in a younger generation a group of people coming along who are saying, yeah, let's work this out together. That we here in the United States don't have all of the answers. Nobody has all of the answers, but working together, we can find those answers and we'll do it. I'll mention somebody. I kind of finish up the book with just, and I only mention her name. That's all.
We didn't even talk about Peter Yarrow. I can't believe we left
it out. We didn't even get into Peter. My God, my dear friend Peter Yarrow. Another time. But I only mentioned the name of a young lady named Riada Asimovic, who is from Kosovo, went to Hamilton College. She was a number one scholar in high school and in college. George Soros paid her way through school because he just recognized that there's this brilliant young lady still going to school. And I only met her once, but we've corresponded ever since. Here's this incredibly brilliant, multi-talented, extraordinary young lady who just has this set of values. And the reason I mention her is she's not from America. She's over there in Kosovo, but doing extraordinary work, leading this global life. And I see young people like Riada. She's Muslim, by the way. Absolutely devoted to building a world of peace, devoted to cross-cultural understanding and making this world better. It's the Riada Asimovics from all over the world that I see as the hope for the future. And every time I get to meet with them and talk with them, I just get a big smile and say, the best thing I can do is get out of the way and let them take over.
Charles Dombeck's book, Exhaust the Limits, The Life and Times of a Global Peace Builder. Chick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
It's been great.
Great to be with you.
You too. You can join Chick Dombeck to hear more about his life and work for peace on May the 5th at 7 p.m. at the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. For more information, or to RSVP, contact Jan Tonso, JANTONSO, at gmu.edu. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web. SteinerShow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.